Kirby Monsters is a podcast about facing the unknown.
I start to float away from the earth.
Have you ever smoked crack before?
We're all kind of frantically searching for meaning.
They have the neurotransmitters.
I think we're all juggalos in some way.
Yo, we're not broken.
Crazed delinquents.
We're in our last days, young man.
Listen to Here Be Monsters,
the podcast about the unknown,
on the KCRW iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. This, for me, is a very special Bookworm. We have as our guest Don DeLillo, whose new novel, Zero K, came out on the 3rd. And so we're among the first people to be able to talk directly with Don DeLillo about his new book. You've mentioned that your books begin with a particular spark or image. What began Zero K for you?
Well, Zero K began with a false image. It was an image that I found quite interesting of a gathering of high-rise buildings with nothing around them and a river just flowing past somewhere in a wilderness. Modern buildings, a cluster of perhaps 6 or 7, no sign of people. And I wondered where this would take me, and it turns out that it took me nowhere. I had to think a little further and somehow ended up in a kind of desert waste in a very distant part of the world, the area of Uzbekistan and its neighboring states.
Well, in addition, these buildings went underground by the time they reached the novel, yes?
In effect, that's what happened. And why is underground better than above ground? And I don't have a specific answer, except that it seemed that the activities taking place at this facility called the Convergence would be best concealed in a remote part of the world and at a depth that few people would even be aware of.
As I was reading, I remembered a song that my parents sometimes sang to me. It was a song that Hoagy Carmichael wrote with Johnny Mercer. It was called How Little We Know. I think they wrote it for the film To Have and Have Not. And I started thinking about this book and some of your others, that the extraordinary part of the narration and the sentence making is about how little we know. If a former kind of novel wrote about omniscience, how much we know, these novels tend to explore those areas where our brain goes numb. Does that have any relevance for you?
Well, I think these novels do conform somewhat to that description. What happens next is, in a profound sense, is rarely available. At least to me, and in this novel, we do know what the hopes and aspirations are of the people who run this facility, but we don't know exactly how it will all work out. And I suppose the same is true for the human element, the people, the family who are deeply engaged in this book. The narrator, Jeff Lockhart, and his father, Ross, and his stepmother, Arthas.
They are the Lockharts. It's a good American name, Ross Lockhart, and he has constructed himself as a billionaire. And he's funded this operation in a wasteland where underground scientists, ethicists, if that's a word, they're constructing a new life after death. The body will be frozen. The mind will be maintained separately. The idea is that in some future, when the body's ills can be healed, the people will be restored, those people wealthy enough to participate in the experiment at the convergence. But they only dimly are aware that they're dependent upon a world safe enough to come back to, and that the problems in the book, therefore how little we know, are in a way unimaginable and insoluble. How does a writer do that?
Well, a writer takes a leap of one kind or another. A writer can follow his impulses. And in the case of the future, this book is based, or these characters are very much invested in a future in which new lives can take place without danger. And of course, they have no way of knowing what the future will bring, perhaps 15, perhaps 25 years before people in their cryonic pods will be able to emerge due to whatever great technological advances are made between now and then. So it's all an enormous amount of guesswork. But of course, this isn't pure fiction. That is, there are such facilities, and people do have such hopes. The big element in this book, as far as I'm concerned, that completely separates itself from reality is that one of the characters, that is Ross Ockhart, the narrator's father, wants to be part of this cryonic procedure, even though he is nowhere near dying. He's a healthy man in his 60s. And in effect, he is asking to be murdered. At least that's one way to look at it. Of course, those who are going to perform the procedure itself don't look at it that way. They are simply taking his money in order to allow him to undergo the procedure.
As I was reading, I'd find some of the book very funny, some of it very sad and complexly moving, and then sometimes both at once. Are those appropriate emotions, or am I overreading?
You're not overreading, and they're human emotions. There is humor. I mean, I intended it. I don't know whether I could cite particular passages, but it's there in a sentence here and there, in a remark here and there. And this is simply part of their personality. This is not something I sketch in advance. This is something that a character simply develops toward. It happens in quite an organic kind of way. A character will just take a certain stance. He will become a certain kind of person as the pages develop and as my mind begins to absorb what sort of person, what sort of character he or she is.
One of the remarkable incursions of an odd comedy comes during a board meeting. Some 9 people, a jury's worth of wealthy billionaires, are being addressed. And among the people addressing them are 2 twins. The narrator assumes they're Scandinavians. He gives them names. They're the Stenmark twins. And he assumes that they're Jan and Lars, or Nils and Sven. But they're twin stand-up comedians of a sort, and their sensibility, the narrator assumes, has shaped this vast convergence underground of screens and false doors and elevators that move sideways. It's a peaceful but frighteningly hectic environment. Our narrator imagines that they've married twin wives too, and that they all four go walking in forests, the women first and then the men first, that it's a ritual. Here they are. This is Don DeLillo reading a section from Zero K.
We spent 6 years here without a break, immersed in our work. Then a journey home, brief but fulfilling, and back and forth ever since. When the time comes, there is a certain inevitability in these words. When the time comes, we'll depart finally from our secure northern home to this desert place, old and frail, limping and shuffling, to approach the final reckoning. What will we find here? A promise more assured than the ineffable hereafters of the world's organized religions. Do we need a promise? Why not just die? Because we're human and we cling, in this case, not to religious tradition, but to the science of present and future. They were speaking quietly and intimately, with a deeper reciprocity than in the earlier exchanges, and not a trace of self-display. The audience was stilled, completely fixed. Ready to die does not mean willing to disappear. Body and mind may tell us that it is time to leave the world behind, but we will clutch and grasp and scratch nevertheless. Two stand-up comics, encased in vitreous matter, refashioned cell by cell, waiting for the time. When the time comes, we'll return. Who will we be? What will we find? The world itself, decades away. Think of it, or sooner or later. Not so easy to imagine what will be out there, better or worse, or so completely altered, we will be too astonished to judge. They spoke about ecosystems of the future planet, theorizing a renewed environment, a ravaged environment, and then Lars held up both hands to signal a respite. It took a moment for the audience to absorb the tradition, but soon the room settled into silence, the Stenmark's silence. The brothers themselves stared dead ahead, empty-eyed. The Stenmarks were in their early 50s. This is where I placed them. So thin-skinned and pale that branching blue veins were visible on the backs of their hands, even from where I stood. I decided that they were street anarchists of an earlier era, quietly dedicated to plotting local outrages or larger insurrections, all shaped by their artistic skills. And then I found myself wondering if they were married, yes, to sisters. I saw them walking in a wooded area, all four, the brothers ahead, then the sisters ahead, a family custom, a game, the distance between the couples coolly measured and carefully maintained. In my half-mad imagining, it would be 5 meters. I made it a point to measure in meters, not in feet or yards. Lars dropped his arms. The pause ended. The twins resumed speaking. Some of you may be back here as well to witness the passage of loved ones. And of course, you've begun to consider what such a passage might be like for yourselves. One day, each of you, when the time comes. We understand that some of the things we've been saying here today may act as disincentives. This is okay. This is the simple truth of our perspective, but do this. Think of money and immortality. Here you are, collected, convened. Isn't this what you've been waiting for? A way to claim the myth for yourselves? Life everlasting belongs to those of breathtaking wealth.
Don DeLillo, reading a section from his new novel, Zero K. Now, Don, when the time comes in that passage, acts as a kind of refrain, and one imagines these brothers shuffling and doing more or less a routine about death for billionaires who are convened to consider the prospect they're being pitched to. And that's what I mean. In a certain sense, I, as a reader, was suspended between awe and laughter during this passage.
The twins are a pair of interesting people. What they do is first, they do a near comic routine concerning the problems that the planet faces and the difficulties of living well into the next century, perhaps, of something that approaches eternal life. They joke about this, but in fact, they plan to be part of this procedure themselves when the time comes. And this is what they're talking about now.
When the time comes, it's a phrase that seems to be a part of what you call early in the book theology-based technology.
there is no specific reference to God. That is, no specific reference to belief in God. The twins do ask each other, if we have this era of global longevity, what happens to art? What happens to God? And I don't think they have an answer. But they deeply believe in the process itself, and they are willing to be part of it physically.
The convergence as a spot is a place where not just the twins who helped design it, not just Ross who helped fund it, but there's a monk-like figure who we meet first in a room where food units are served. And he says he doesn't want to live forever. When he dies, he wants to be done with it. He wants to be dead. And the book invokes the problems of eternal life and the vast wealth that buys immortality. I mean, in a certain sense, what else is there to buy? What could you possibly pay for that would require all that money? And so the book has a certain sense of the ugliness of aspiration. Is that a usable phrase?
Well, I think what you said is exactly the way in which Ross Lockhart is thinking. He is thinking, what else can I do with my money? And he prefers to buy this immortality, if he can, now instead of perhaps 15 or 20 years later when his health is severely challenged. So this is the thinking of this particular important character, and he is willing to follow it ultimately after a great deal of indecision. And his purpose is not completely egocentric. His beloved woman is now part of the cryonic process, and he simply wants to join her.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Don DeLillo about his book Zero K. We'll continue after this short break.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Don DeLillo about his latest book, Zero K, An Expression of Life and Life After Death. Now, when we return to the world outside the convergence, we learn that our narrator, Jeffrey, is someone like a lot of us readers. He doesn't know what to be in the world. His mother has died. His father has, at least to his experience of it, abandoned them. He seems, in the years between his father's departure, to have conceived a certain affection for Artis, his stepmother. But he doesn't want to be bought a job with his father's money. It was enough that his father's money paid for his education. And I would wager that a lot of people reading Zero K are in that situation that many of us face of not knowing what to do in the world while this book is examining the life to come. It's like I put my hands to my head and said, oh no, the life to come. What about this one? How do we make do here? What are we going to do in the midst of what the book considers to be a dying ecology? It's almost as if these people are being crowned at the end of a checkers game with a king checker. They're moving on to the next field of play, leaving us behind to face our problems in this one on our own, huh?
Well, Jeff Lockhart intentionally chooses jobs, and he changes them fairly quickly. He intentionally chooses jobs that are completely meaningless to him and perhaps to anyone else. And they are even jobs that have titles that one has difficulty trying to remember. I can't remember any of them offhand right now myself. So he's living as, in many ways, a normal human being who happens to be immersed in a kind of anonymity, a self-anonymity. And this may well be a reaction to his father's glowing career, his father on the cover of Newsweek, his father with enormous money, his father with a retreat in Maine where he allows artists to come and work on their paintings and sculpture. It's a kind of life in retreat that Jeff follows. He happens to be quite intelligent. He has a girlfriend, there's a problem in that relationship, but he lives very, very strictly day to day, and he sees things that others don't. He understands what is happening when he crosses a street, the street lights, the number of seconds he has in which to get to the other side before the light goes red and the taxis bear down on him, that sort of thing. He lives almost in the microsecond, not just in the moment.
Wow. Now, would you say that he's a representative sample? Don't most of us lead these kind of alienated lives in the microsecond?
I think he may be an extreme sample. But other people would have to learn more about him and decide for themselves. But I think his life represents something that many of us, perhaps most of us, are quite familiar with, at least at times.
Rachel Kushner was among the young writers whose work you have endorsed, among them Dana Spiotta, Joshua Cohen. How are you feeling about the writing going on among younger writers today?
Younger writers are still doing serious work and uncompromising work, work that may find an audience or work that may not. And this is very encouraging. And they're not cautious about such matters as the length of a novel. Whatever it takes, this is what they're doing. They're following their impulses and their talent, and there are quite a few of them. I can't list names, but I do read this work, and I am quite often very impressed.
Well, I think, I know, your endorsement has been going on for years, and people as, well, various as Jonathan Franzen or David Foster Wallace would talk to me about exchanging letters with you. Many writers do not do that, stay in touch with the younger generation. You do very much so. Why is it important? Or is it important?
Well, it's very encouraging to me to be in touch with younger writers who show serious interest in extending the novel itself and extending the form of the novel itself, which is an enormous challenge to any fiction writer. And there are people who are doing it right here in this country today, and I like it. It makes me feel better about the work I do.
As I was reading Zero K, I began to think that for others, the other life is perhaps life after death. But for us, for readers, the other life is the life we enter when reading. And for me, the convergence was a place not that I would find in the next world if I was wealthy enough, but in this world if I read avidly enough.
Well, that's a wonderful insight. I would imagine you've been doing it for decades. And my only remark is, keep on going.
Thank you, Don. That was great.
You're welcome. I enjoy talking to you, Michael. And who knows, maybe again in 4 or 5 years.
Yes, I hope that will be the case. I love the state of mind that your work induces in me. Thank you.
Thanks.
I've been talking with the honored American writer, Don DeLillo. Thank you very, very much for being willing to spend time with us. And I really highly recommend the book Zero K to all readers. He does not give many interviews. It's been a great honor and favor. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Zero K by Don DeLillo is published by Scribner. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Zero K at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Garth Greenwell is our guest.